Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York, via the Paranormal Radio Network, and also on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and on my guests, visit our website at www.keyholepublishing.com. Thanks for joining me this evening. And as always, I want to hear from you. If you're listening live tonight, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium, and you can participate in the conversation there through instant messaging. You can also email me with your questions and comments anytime at kdolan@rochester.rr.com. You can also call into the show toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And if you miss any of that, it's all on the webpage at www.keyholepublishing.com. As everyone realizes, today's date is September 11th, 2009. It's the 8th anniversary of the day that 4 planes were hijacked by terrorists. Nearly 3,000 people lost their lives. Two of the aircraft crashed into the two towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. One struck the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and the last came down in a field in Pennsylvania. Apparently, it was on its way back to the Capitol building, also in Washington. That's the official account, but there are still many inconsistencies and gaps 8 years after the events that still have to be explained. Tonight, in honor of all of those who lost their lives as a result of the events on that day, and also in honor of their friends and families who I believe deserve some answers, I've asked historian Richard Dolan to talk with me tonight about some of his research into what really happened on September 11th, 2001. Rich, welcome to Through the Keyhole, and thanks for joining me on the show again.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you.
Wow, I almost got choked up just saying that.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe it's been eight years already.
We are 8 years into a kind of a nightmare, in a way, you know, how all of this has affected the world. I still remember very clearly when that day occurred, and at the moment it happened, you and I were in different places, but you quickly got home, I remember.
Yeah, I was taking a class that morning. I came out, got in the car to come home and have lunch, turned on the radio, thinking, oh, I'm going to hear some fun music, and I heard a DJ or radio announcer with a really odd note in his voice talking about the fire. And I didn't know what he was talking about, and I sat there and listened, and I thought I had turned on a radio show or so. I thought it was some kind of War of the Worlds kind of thing. I didn't understand it for the longest time, and I couldn't make sense of it even after I knew what they were talking about.
Right. Yeah, it shocked us all, and I think it took me, anyway, at least a good year to step back a little bit with some detachment and really look with a fresh approach at what happened on 9/11. You were a little more on the ball than I was, I would say, right out of the box there. It's funny because when you and I met, you were so naive and politically not particularly knowledgeable back in those days, but you've come a lot farther than I've gone in a lot of ways, I have to say. And I think on that day, you were a lot more on the ball than I was.
Well, thank you. I would have preferred to be wrong about that one.
You were suspicious that things were not right.
Yeah,
you
were suspicious for the benefit of people listening to this who weren't there for our conversation on that day, I had a feeling that there was more to it than what we were seeing on TV.
And I said basically, you know, now, come on, that's crazy talk. And then we kind of let it go, and we were all just washed over by all the shock and awe of everything that followed in its wake. And what happened with me was, because I was known to some extent in the world by having written a book on UFOs and conspiracies and things like that, people would write to me and and say, Rich, you really need to look at what happened on 9/11. There's something that's wrong with that explanation. And for a while, my attitude was, well, maybe yes, maybe no. I really have no idea, but I'll get to it when I get to it. Right now, I'm looking at other things. I was doing a lot of UFO writing and so on. But one day, I finally took the time to visit some of the websites that people were pointing me to. And I then, not too long after that, purchased a copy of David Ray Griffin's first book on 9/11 called The New Pearl Harbor. I'm sure many people listening have read this book. Griffin is an academician. He's a very experienced professor, theologian by training. I think he's written more than 10 books already for the academic world. And just got interested in...
I'd forgotten that he was a theologian.
Yeah, that's right. And just started looking into the arguments that some people were putting out. And I think, like, what I loved about his approach is that he didn't really try to answer a lot of questions so much as ask some very difficult questions regarding the official explanations of what happened that day. And for anybody who's still on the fence about this or who thinks it's all nonsense, a lot of crazy talk, I would encourage them to read Griffin's book. It's not 100% up to date. There's been research continuing on 9/11, obviously. But as an attempt to open the door to questions, I think it's still an outstanding introduction to this topic. It certainly was for me. And once I read Griffin's book, that really did it for me. And this was about, a year, a little more than a year, certainly, into all this. But I took a lot of time away from my other studies and really dived into 9/11.
Which was hard because you had to be feeling like, I'm not getting into that crazy UFO or 9/11 conspiracy stuff. I'm a UFO guy.
That's right. And I had a lot of pushback, let's say, from other researchers who really were advising me not to get into looking at 9/11.
And I thought that was really interesting because I was sort of feeling like we're already talking about UFOs.
Yeah, we're already on the outside, aren't we?
Exactly.
Right,
and we're already talking government cover-up. This fits right in from my point of view, but I was really surprised by the number of people we've met on both sides who have said, oh, you're into 9/11. Oh, great job doing that research. What, you read about UFOs?
Yeah.
Or people who said, well, stick to UFOs. Don't get into that 9/11 stuff.
Right, exactly. It's on both sides. For the 9/11 researchers, honestly, I have no complaint with them trying to keep UFO people out. I mean, look, they've got enough to deal with here. They're already ridiculed. They're already, I mean, I just saw a ridiculous hit piece by Sean Hannity that was just on video today on Charlie Sheen, who as an actor, Charlie Sheen is one of the most prominent people out there who is openly questioning the official version of events on 9/11. And Hannity, of course, over at Fox News, just did a 60-second hit piece that essentially insulted Charlie Sheen, made him out to look like a fool. Of course, didn't address any of the very excellent points that Charlie Sheen had been raising for the past few days on this.
Well, that's the only way to respond to something like that when you don't have an answer.
Exactly. It's like a guy or someone who's bowling, and you've bowled a really poor ball, and you try to use your body English to make it, move it to the hit to get a strike.
Yeah.
Because that's all you can do, and that's what these people do. They have no argument. So they use these other methods to distract people from the fact that they have no response. But I started diving into 9/11. I'll never forget. I think it was in a conference that you and I were at in 2004. And that was the first time that I did a public presentation on that dealt with 9/11. And this was at a UFO conference. I'm trying to remember even where.
Trying to remember which one.
Might have been Los Angeles in 2004. But the people wouldn't let me leave. I remember I was supposed to go up until lunchtime, and
Oh, was that the one where they wouldn't let you stop talking because it was a dinner break? It was
dinner, yeah.
And they said, nobody else is coming in right now. We'll stay and have our dinner here.
Right. They would not let me leave, literally. And I went for another half hour, 45 minutes, I think. Well into dinner time. People have a hunger for truth. The problem is we're in a country now, we're in a world, it's not just the United States, it's everywhere, in which people know that there is something desperately wrong with their country, with their society, and the problem is they don't, unfortunately, most people, they work 40, 50, 60 hour weeks, they don't have time to research, they don't have time to fight the power.
I don't believe that's an accident either. I don't think that's a coincidence.
People have worked hard throughout human history, but no, I'm inclined to agree with you. I mean, certainly when they come home, it's no accident that the television they watch is full of nothing but crap.
Well, see, I think it's also no accident that the economy is in such a state that people are forced to work 60, 70, 80-hour weeks, and that they are too exhausted to do anything but turn on the game for a little while and go to bed.
That's right. And so when people, they're not in a position to investigate. They're not in a position to read hundreds of books and search the web for the most part. There are those of us who are. I mean, you and I are that way. Probably most of the people listening are this way. But even that's a minority. Most people, so they know there's something wrong, but they don't have, I mean, literally they don't have the conceptual tools to understand. And by that I simply mean, most people have not had an opportunity to get beyond the most basic understanding of how they think the world is. How many people can really tell what are the largest corporations in the world? What are the largest non-governmental organizations in the world? Who the Bilderberger Group is? What the Council on Foreign Relations is? What is the nature of the Federal Reserve Bank? I mean, we've all heard these concepts and things being bandied about, but very few people really have the time or even the knowledge of how to begin to investigate these things. And it's only because I feel like, I don't know what kind of person I am, I'm kind of bizarre fanatic, that I've decided for whatever reason to devote my life into understanding these things. And even that, it's taken me years to try to get, to be able to get some kind of basic handle on things. And so it's very difficult. So people have this hunger for truth because they know somehow they're getting spoon-fed a lot of BS from their society.
We look at that official story, when we read news stories or see anything on TV, now I'm sure that there's been a lot on TV and in the news today, which I was avoiding watching, but I'm sure there have been a lot of stories coming out just today, look back at September 11th.
Yeah, I haven't even bothered to look. I can't take
this stuff. We just don't. I get my news from places like this. Yeah. I get it from talking to you.
The party line is so rigid. It's literally, it's like the Spanish Inquisition. Just a couple of weeks ago, one of Barack Obama's top advisors was forced out of his office because 4 or 5 years ago he signed a petition on 9/11 truth. And now, I mean, here's the thing. So some members of the opposing party found this, and they hounded this man from office, and he's out. Now, do you really think that no one in Washington suspects that 9/11 is not as it appeared? No, everyone suspects it. Okay? But to bring up this issue publicly or to be outed on it is an absolute political death.
I remember about a week after 9/11 occurred, when we still had the TV on and we were watching the news programs about it all the time, I remember seeing Condoleezza Rice come on, and she actually said that it was unpatriotic to be questioning the official story of what happened that day.
Absolutely.
I couldn't believe she actually came out and said that.
She said it.
Some kind of crazy thing somebody like me would say.
Right.
But this is the official statement going out on TV.
President Bush also said it. A number of people at the very top of the White House power structure said this. And what's crazy is that the more and more people look into the details of what happened on that day, the more it's it's obvious. The more it is obvious that the official version of events is bald-faced lies. It's not even like they, you know, that they allowed it to happen to get their, you know, agenda done. No. There is stuff going on with the facts on the ground about 9/11 that are damning to the official version of events. And
okay,
let's
go over that then.
I would be very happy to. The one thing that I would preface...
The official story and what's
right.
Not right about it.
I would like to preface this, though, simply by reminding people that governments and the United States government as well as every other government that you could probably think of have long, long histories of lying to their people about all kinds of things. And this is how things are done. And I'm not talking about little matters. I'm talking about matters that bring nations into wars. If you want to go back through American history, go back a little over a century to the great battle cry, Remember the Maine. This was an event in 1898 when the United States was having escalated saber-rattling with the nation of Spain over events in Cuba. A U.S. ship off the coast of Cuba suddenly blew up. It was blamed on the Spanish. We know it was not the Spanish. And the truth of the Maine may never be fully out, but it is clear that event was used in order to justify the war, and it was not the Spanish that did it. There's a very good chance that it was an arranged event. There was an infamous document known as the Zimmerman Telegram that was critically involved in getting the United States into World War I. More shenanigans. I'll spare you the details. Do a Google on it or look it up in Wikipedia. Then we have Pearl Harbor. Now, when I was a grad student, about 20 years ago, it was still academic suicide to imply that Pearl Harbor was something that the Roosevelt administration allowed to happen. Now, it took over 50 years until some mainstream academicians finally said, you know what, there really is a lot of evidence to show that Roosevelt and Chief of Staff Marshall and other people wanted and allowed Pearl Harbor to happen. Then you get the infamous Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1965, in which, again, the United States manipulated a non-event into being an event and was able to hoodwink the American people and Congress, especially Congress, into giving a blank check into escalating the war in Vietnam. And that was all based on a series of bald-faced lies. The United States has a long history of this, but of course the great analogy, and it's not hyperbole to mention. The great analogy to 9/11, as many, many people have pointed out, is something that took place in Germany in 1933, the infamous Reichstag fire. And just to make a very quick summary of that, Adolf Hitler was not elected to be dictator of Germany. He was elected to be chancellor. And in fact, he wasn't even truly elected ever by a majority of the German people. He had a plurality. He was selected to be the leader of a coalition to head a government in Germany in January 1933. A month and a half later, the German parliament, their congress, was called the Reichstag, was set ablaze. It was just like 9/11. There's a picture of it. Every window, there's fire, flames coming out. It's an amazing photograph. The German people were horror-struck by this act of terrorism. Well, we know for sure the Nazis planned it and they did it. They blamed the communists and used that event to pass emergency powers for Hitler. That became the foundation for his dictatorship, the Third Reich, which lasted 12 years. And I'll guarantee you, okay, that the patriotic German citizens, most of them probably could not conceive that their own government would be behind such a heinous act, or if they did, as here in America, maybe they were too afraid to speak up. Okay, but it did happen.
Patriotic.
That's right. So in other words, there are examples. We like to think in America, oh, well, our government doesn't do that. Well, our government has done that and much more. Conspiracy, lies, this is a way of life. And what people need to get beyond is their elementary school you know, civics class idea of how the American government works. You know, you elect your member of Congress, and then there's the president, and let's not forget the Supreme Court, and checks and balances, and all of this stuff.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, yeah.
The world is not like that anymore. We've moved into something very different. The problem that everybody has, as I see it, not just, I mean, including people who've spent many years in the university world, is they don't have an understanding, a proper handle on the transnational nature of the structure of power in this world.
This is getting a little more into the behind the scenes, the, you know, who's...
Yeah, I'm getting, okay, I haven't really gotten into the problem.
I'd like to start just by talking about the events of that day and what was the discrepancy in the story.
Thanks for reining me in. You know how
no
I can get.
Well, I know that you are brilliant and you have great information. I just want to stay focused so that somebody who is new to this, because there are a lot of people who lived through that time. It was only 8 years ago. But maybe have it.
Well, yeah. Let's start with some simple
things.
Okay? Let's pretend that we're crime scene investigators. And the first place that we go is to the ground zero of the World Trade Center. So we're down with the rubble, and we're down with all the dust. And, all that horror.
Oh, they found a passport.
Well, that's one of the things. They found a nice-looking passport belonging to Mohammed Atta, the alleged leader of the hijacking, and the reminiscence of the magic bullet of Lee Harvey Oswald that was found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital. But I wasn't even getting to that point yet.
Yeah.
What I would say is the first thing you can do when looking at the World Trade Center is very simple. Go to YouTube and look at the time that it takes for those towers to collapse. There's been a lot of work done on this, of course. Those towers fell at, let us say, virtual free fall speed. And so that, in other words, if you were to have taken a brick at the rooftop level of the top floor of the World Trade Center, it would have landed in approximately, 9 seconds. 9 to 10 seconds. The towers collapsed in about that time. They collapsed in, it's hard to know exactly because of all the dust, but the best estimate, even by the 9/11 commission, is that the towers fell each in approximately 10 seconds. Maybe 11, but probably not more than that. So that, in other words,
now would be that where the plane struck, if I'm understanding this correctly, where the plane struck, then the floor below that one, like from the wall where the plane struck the building down to the floor, should have collapsed, and then the weight of that falling on the level below should have caused that to collapse, and then that weight...
Well, that's the discredited pancake theory. And in fact, that's actually no longer held even by the official version of events. That was the event, that was the explanation that was put out by Popular Mechanics and the establishment. But in fact, it was proven mathematically that that cannot be the case. So now they have a different theory to explain that, which is actually not even, it's so counterintuitive, and it's just all done by computer generation. It's called the Boeing theory. I'm getting ahead of myself. It's a very,
it doesn't have to be this complicated.
Look,
the fall should have been delayed by all of those supports and walls.
Well, yes, because in fact, there were people who were able to go, who were above where the plane slammed into the towers, who were literally able to go and escape. Okay? So think about this. All right, so if you're up on the 85th floor, there were people up in the 83rd, 84th, 85th floor who were able to get past the 78th floor where one of the planes had slammed into the building, and there was all this fire that was supposed to be. I was listening to an interview by one executive. He went through that. He said it was a little warm, but you could tell that it was an oxygen-starved fire, and there was some flames licking through, but it wasn't all that bad. And as soon as we got below that level, he said, it was perfect. The air conditioning, the air was still working. It was perfect. There was no problem. So that whole part of the building was perfectly secure. It was perfectly fine. And now, this is important because And also, the other thing to keep in mind is that there are photographs of human beings standing literally at the point where the jets slammed into the building. Okay, so there's a big hole in the building, and there's a picture of a woman standing in that spot. In other words, that flame, the flames obviously could not have been significant because you have a human being standing right there. Here's what I want to say, alright? Structures, when they collapse at a free fall speed, do so under one condition. When they are brought down artificially by means of some sort of demolition. And the North Tower and the South Tower, and let us not forget building number 7 of the World Trade Center complex, which was a large structure. It was 47 stories tall and was hit by no aircraft at all. Building 7 also collapsed at free fall speed 7 hours later. Now the fire, there was a fire that was in Building 7. It appears to have been initiated when the North Tower collapsed. Okay, now it's true that the collapse of the North Tower would very likely did damage Building 7. And there were fires there, and certainly I would not want to be someone to have to put out the fires, but this was not the towering inferno. The photographs that we have of that fire do not show a raging inferno at all. When buildings collapse at free fall speed, they're brought down by demolition only. But not only that, those buildings came down in huge mounds of dust. And this is also indicative of demolition. If you want to look at photographs of other buildings that collapse, go to any sites that deal with the Kobe, Japan earthquake of 1995. Now, those buildings were also, many of them were ruined by a massive earthquake, of course, that destroyed a big part of that city. But what you won't find is dust. You won't find buildings that collapse perfectly on their own footprint at free fall speed. That doesn't happen. You find a lot of big hunks of rubble and buildings twisted and knocked over, yeah. But what happened in New York City was unprecedented and has never been replicated, by the way, naturally, without demolition. So let's say that you're a crime scene investigator and you're investigating, some horrible homicide. And let's say I'm your main suspect. But I tell you, oh no, Karen, I didn't do it. My next door neighbor, though, this guy who wears a turban, he's kind of suspicious. I think you should be looking at him. Would you be doing your job if you said, oh, thanks a lot, Rich. I'll go arrest him. And this was exactly what happened. The primary suspect, when you start looking, like why NORAD fell asleep all morning, why the FAA was supposed to be so utterly incompetent. This is all of these things are just absurd.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are excellent points. Those are really, to my mind, some of the best evidence.
Where were the jet fighters that were supposed to be scrambled? No one got a straight answer out of the Pentagon. Ever.
Yeah.
For days and days and days, Pentagon initially said, we didn't scramble any jet fighters. And then some reporter said, what? They went a few days later.
I want to back up for just a second, Rich, because there's a question on the message board about the photo that you mentioned.
Which photo?
You said there was a photo of a woman standing in an opening. Where could somebody see that?
Good question. I have it on a couple of videos.
Okay, people are questioning the legitimacy of that photo. And in fact, one person pointed out that a photo is sort of a moment in time and that, you know, maybe that was taken just a second before she may have died.
No, I don't think so.
But it's
a fair question.
Video, okay, that's a good point. If it came from a video, this is not just a single second that we're looking at here.
I recommend, if this person is speaking out of knowledge, that's one thing, but if this is just something that popped into his or her head, I would advise them, someone is asking,
you know, how can we be sure that that photo is accurate?
There are collections of official collections of 9/11 photographs.
Okay. So this is one of the official photos.
Certainly no one has questioned it.
Okay.
To my knowledge,
questioned. So what we're saying is it's not likely that somebody who is challenging the official version of events, cooked this up in Photoshop and then is waving it around as proof that the official story is wrong.
No.
This is actually part of the official body of evidence that's being presented.
Yes.
And if you look at the evidence that they're putting out.
Yeah. I'm sorry that I don't have the, in front of me here. I don't.
Okay, well, I mean,
I've seen that photo many, many times.
It came from a video.
And the point is, anyway, that the, you know, the explanation for the collapse of the towers is itself very suspicious. The first explanation for the collapse came out, I have a copy of the PDF here, of the file. It came out 3 days later. It came out, I believe, on September 14th, if you can imagine, from an engineering PhD who had access to absolutely no data whatsoever. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I read the paper. And I can say point blank that this is made with out of thin air. He cooked up his numbers out of pure nothingness. He had nothing to work off of, and in fact, several years later, had to admit this. and then tweaked his numbers a little bit more to give himself. But the point is, why would somebody put out a paper immediately trying to explain how the towers could collapse as they did? It's ridiculous. I mean, the steel below the area where the planes impacted were not heated in any way. There should have been resistance. We're talking about 100 floors of steel. They don't just collapse like a stack of house of cards. Ask yourself this question. All right, if free fall speed is 10 seconds, how much resistance per floor should we expect from hardened, undamaged steel? Should it be 1 second per floor? A half of a second per floor? If it's 1 second per floor, that still would add more than a minute to the speed of collapse. If it's a half of a second per floor, that would still add a half of a minute and more to the collapse. If it's 1/10 of a second, which is really insignificant when you think about it, even that, if you add the bottom 80 floors, that's 8 seconds. And it didn't even take 18 seconds to collapse. There is, in other words, no resistance, no effective resistance offered by any of those floors to the speed of collapse of either the North Tower, the South Tower, or again, Building 7. This is, at least, if nothing else, this would have to be enough to cause any reasonable independent researcher to say, wait a minute, what is your explanation for this? And in fact, there is no explanation, even to this day, that accounts for the speed of collapse of those towers. None. I defy anyone to go look for them. I've looked. The so-called scientific literature does not at all get into the speed of collapse. At all.
There's a comment on the website that says, person says, the way I heard it, the towers behaved in precisely the manner they were designed to. It's a testament to the expertise of the architects who designed them.
Those towers were supposed to withstand multiple impacts of jet airliners.
Yeah.
And that is also what the designers said. Okay. So that's problem number one, is the World Trade Center. And plus, of course, this great crime scene was not analyzed. None of the steel was available for any forensic analysis whatsoever. All of it was taken and shipped out of the country and said it's scrap metal. There is no doubt, we're told that there was an investigation. No one's ever seen it. No one's ever been able to read it.
I've seen quite a few interviews with people who were trying to carry out an investigation, and they were saying, I don't have anything to look at. All my evidence is gone.
Now let's switch gears to the Pentagon. Oh, and incidentally, at the World Trade Center, there was molten metal weeks after the collapse beneath the rubble. Molten metal. Right? Some of these girders showed signs of having been melted, which you would need temperatures of outrageously high temperatures, and the jet fuel from the jetliners did not and could not attain such temperatures. More than double what a jetliner would be required to attain. Also, the other thing to point out is that sulfur, large quantities of sulfur were detected in the dust of the Trade Center. And this is a key now toward what is known as thermite or thermite. Right? And there's been a recent study that came out, published on the web. I've read this study, and it's a very impressive and detailed study dealing with thermitic pyrotechnics in the World Trade Center samples. In other words, what happened is after the buildings came down, dust went everywhere. A lot of people kept samples of dust. At a 9/11 truth meeting a couple of years later, the call went out by researchers for anyone who had samples of dust. Okay, so there were five or six people that I believe said, yes, I have dust. They all provided researchers, scientists with this dust. All these different people provided, the dust samples were remarkably consistent, and all of them showed signs at a microscopic level of something that absolutely should not have been there. And what that is advanced, highly energetic thermite. Now, regular thermite is an incredibly effective explosive, and you don't just find this stuff lying around. But this
it would never be used in construction? And they wouldn't use it for welding or anything like that?
No, because it's used to blow things up.
Okay, that's really all it does.
It's thermite, when it's heated to a certain temperature, causes explosions. And that's why it's valuable, because it's a great explosive. The type of thermite that we're talking about is only available within the military. It's thermate. And it's nano-engineered. In other words, it's incredibly highly integrated with itself, right? So that it's vastly more energetic than regular thermite. And it was this highly energetic thermite that was found in all of the dust samples that were provided for the World Trade, for the WTC scientists and analysts. Now, of course, the mainstream media will simply say, well, these samples, you know, who knows where they come from. This could all be a big concocted hoax. Which, okay, let's say that that's possible. But this thermite, all of the samples were completely consistent, very difficult to get. The individuals who donated the dust samples have all been interviewed. They're all available for anyone to see. They're regular people. Any reasonable mind looking at this is going to think, this is a smoking gun. So, let's leave this World Trade Center for the moment. I'd like to move over to the Pentagon, because I think the Pentagon is at least as interesting.
One thing I just want to mention before we move away is there's a bit of an argument on the message board about whether thermite or thermate is actually used for welding. Now, I'm looking it up on Google here, and I'm seeing results that thermite is used for welding, that thermate is what was found in the World Trade Center.
That's right.
And I believe that's what you were just saying, that thermate.
That is exactly
very
right.
Very different from thermite.
Thermate was only available, as far as anybody knows, to military sources. And we know that it was available no later than 1999 to military contractors. It was fairly recently developed, from what I've said, during the 1990s. I don't think thermate was available in, say, the 1980s, but it became available during the 90s, so not long before 9/11. So, okay, there's that. And I guess I would simply encourage people to look into, read the Thermate article. Just do a Google on Thermate World Trade Center, and you'll find the PDF article. It's fairly readable. There's a lot of technical stuff in there, but it's clear enough. Now, the attack on the Pentagon is yet another strange series of events. The aircraft that was said to have hit the Pentagon was a Boeing 757, Flight 77. The hijacker of the aircraft was said to be a man named Hani Hanjour. Hani Hanjour had, I think, two men with him. And the men had their box cutter knives, and Hani Hanjour 45 minutes out of the flight, and they're now over Ohio, having left D.C., makes his move. Now, just visualize the scene that we're supposed to believe. Armed with his box cutter knife, Hanny Hanjour fights his way to the cockpit, to the cabin, takes out the two pilots. Now, the main pilot of that aircraft, that I saw a photograph of this guy, the former F-4 fighter jock, tough-looking guy, certainly I wouldn't want to have a mess with him. Hanny Hanjour, who was 5'7", weighed probably 140 pounds, soaking wet, somehow takes this pilot out, and the co-pilot has the presence of mind to turn off the plane's transponder. And I say this because, in fact, there is no radar evidence whatsoever that this aircraft ever turned around. But all we know is that it went off radar. Somehow the transponder code was turned off. Now Hanny Hanjour is in charge of this aircraft. Now, he's at 30,000 feet above the clouds, going the wrong way at 500 miles per hour. So we've got to turn this bird around. Now, my question is very simple. How does he do this? And who's vectoring him in? Because he's got to go 500 miles the other way and nail his target with no visibility.
Completely above
cloud cover. That's right. Cloud cover.
I mean, come on. Nowadays, we've all flown. Everybody knows when you look outside and you see clouds.
you can't see. Right. And now, make it even better. This man was an utterly incompetent pilot. How do we know this? Because 1 month before, he had attempted to take a test to fly a single-engine Cessna. Not only could he not do it, he actually left the airport with the airplane on the runway unattended. He just took off. He was described as an incompetent pilot who couldn't even fly this by his flight instructor. So now he's got this Boeing 757 with a wingspan of about 125 feet with all the controls, as you can imagine. It's a complicated device. And he's got to turn it around, okay, without crashing. And he's got to navigate himself. Somehow he becomes, what, better than Christopher Columbus at the art of dead reckoning? I mean, because if you're off even by like half of a degree, you're going to miss your final target by many miles. But somehow Hanny Hanjour pulls off the impossible. And we have to assume no one's vectoring him in, because that would mean there's a conspiracy. So we have to assume he's flying it by himself.
Well, okay, but there is a conspiracy because there are four planes. Okay, there's already
absolutely.
One person involved in that.
Absolutely. And pulled off with military precision, incidentally. I mean, incredible.
We've got 2 minutes to break,
by the way. What's that?
We have 2 minutes to break.
Okay. And then actually I want to return to Mohammed Atta and World Trade Center for a minute. But anyway, Hanny Hanjour flies perfect across the state back to D.C. And then as he approaches the Pentagon, executes a maneuver. At this point, traffic controllers picked him up on radar, and they tracked a maneuver that was so awesome. They literally thought it was one of the F-16s that they'd been waiting for, because by now the country is going crazy. But it wasn't an F-16 pulling off a 270-degree corkscrew spiral maneuver. No. It was Hanny Hanjour, supposedly, making a Boeing, big fat Boeing commercial airliner, which is like an ocean liner in the sky, do this jet fighter maneuver, and then fly his aircraft at an altitude of 20 feet for nearly a mile at the speed of almost 500 miles per hour. And this, in fact, is a physical impossibility. The air is too dense. There's no aircraft that can, no commercial aircraft that can do this. They're not designed to do this. There's an effect known as wind sheeting, which would force that aircraft down unless they pull up. Okay? They can fly level at 30,000 feet, no problem. The air is not so dense. At 20 feet, the air is too dense. But we know something flew at that altitude because the streetlights were shorn off at that height.
Okay. We're going to have to pick this up after the break because it is time. We have gone through the whole first hour already. I don't know about you, but I have been totally fascinated and fascinated by this. I'm just amazed that after 8 years, after the events of September 11, 2001, we still don't know really what happened. We know the official story, but it's not been revisited. It has not been properly investigated. And there still are too many questions and not nearly enough answers. And I want to thank everyone for joining us for the first hour. We have historian Rich Dolan here who's talking about his research into the events of 9/11. And when we come back, we're going to pick up a little more on the World Trade Center and get back to what happened at the Pentagon. You're listening to Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network and UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. Don't go too far. We'll be right back.
The janitor. Man was a hero. He went back in and he had the only key to a particular door to get certain people out. And he went back into the building and dragged out about 20 people. All right?
Wow.
That's right. William Rodriguez is not the only one. But as said, there were explosions below my level. Below where I was. At ground floor, in other words, in the basement level of the World Trade Center. The 9/11 Commission would not accept his testimony. And there were many others who said the exact same thing. Alright. And you've got the establishment out there doing their damage control saying, no, those explosions, only seemed like explosions. There was the collapse of the floors on each other. An explanation, the pancaking, which is not sure to be bogus anyway. Alright. But what Rodriguez said was that the explosions were below his level. So,
if the official story is true, how can that be? How could there be explosions down in, I can't think of any way.
No, there isn't. There can't be.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the truth in the official story here, and it's just not there.
The plane slammed in about 3/4 of the way up. Up. Way, way up there. All right, that's not going to cause explosions down below the ground level.
There's a question on the message board here, changing the subject slightly, but there's a question about the fact that there were survivors who waved flags to the helicopters, or, handkerchiefs, whatever they could find, to helicopters asking and begging for help. The person who wrote said if the fires were that hot, then why were there survivors? I don't think I quite understand that question.
Well, yeah, I think this goes along with what we're talking about here.
Well, the official story was that the fire was hot enough to do this kind of damage to the building, but what we're saying is that it really wasn't.
Precisely.
Okay, there we go.
Right. And look at this smoke coming out of the World Trade Center. This is black smoke. That's oxygen-starved smoke. All right. When you have an oxygen-rich fire, an oxygen-starved fire, not smoke. When you have oxygen-rich fires, smoke is bright white color, not black. And this was black smoke. All right. So again, yes, it was a fire. Yes, it was serious. Okay. But in terms of generating the temperatures that were said to, weaken the steel sufficiently. I mean, all of these are problematic. And then, yes, there's direct testimony of witnesses. Again, I've spent the time trying to go through these videos. People who were above the impact of the plane, who got to a stairwell, and were able to go around.
So below
the level where the air and the circulation was perfect. Air conditioning was still functioning. So this is...
So it just doesn't make sense.
No.
You cannot...
Clearly does not.
...put them together. Okay, there's another question, actually a couple of questions about the World Trade Center. One was about Building 7, In my mind, it's like, what's the deal with Building 7? Why did that one collapse at all?
Right.
It collapsed at the end of the day. It hadn't been hit by anything. It wasn't touching Buildings 1 or 2. But there's a question that has been asked a couple of times, and this one person's been very, very patient with me, about the video in which newscasters reported the collapse of a building before it actually did collapse.
Well, this is true.
How does that happen?
Well, I'd like to get a good explanation for this myself. There's a BBC reporter, a woman, who's talking about the collapse. We have just gotten an announcement. You can find this on YouTube. We've just gotten an announcement that Building 7 has collapsed. And, of course, she didn't know what Building 7 looked like. She's BBC. From behind her and on the camera is Building 7 is clearly visible, in, you know, behind her. So, it was, I don't remember, something like 10 minutes or 15 minutes before the building came down. It wasn't a long period before the building came down. But yeah, they made the announcement. And certainly I'm not saying that she was involved in, I think she was simply used. She was given this information and she reported it. But, the building, was, you know, reported to have come down before it actually did come down, and that is true. I've looked into this. I don't see, I've never seen any counter evidence. No one has ever really tried to debunk that point. So, now what does it mean? I don't know. It could mean that someone screwed up, most likely what it means. And that, she reported a little too early, but there may be some other explanation in there. I don't know what it is, and it's a valid question. Certainly.
It definitely is. I mean, I guess it's always possible when we look at it now, after the fact, it's possible that the date timestamp was wrong. I don't know. And I believe that there was a lot more to this than the official story is stating. But I'm trying to play devil's advocate here and say, okay, is there any way that this could have been a mistake?
Well,
looking at it now, I never heard about it till much later. So yeah, I could say, well, maybe the date stamp was, you know, the time was off on that. But I mean, people saw it earlier, right? People were watching this live.
Yeah, I don't believe the BBC's ever addressed this either.
So that's interesting in itself. If it were something as simple as, oh, well, the time was set wrong on our date stamp thing on the video. Wouldn't they have just said it?
Yeah, I don't.
That's such a simple thing to think.
Yeah. Let me just say, I don't believe that the BBC ever made that claim that the time stamp was wrong.
Yeah, I never heard
either.
I never heard any mention.
As far as I've been able to tell with that particular part of evidence, it's just one of those other things that's just hanging out there, begging for an explanation.
That's
like so much of this.
As far as World Trade Center, Building 7, there's a lot of speculation over what happened there. I remember reading one theory, and it was just a theory, that perhaps Command Central, for orchestrating everything that went on that morning, was actually located in Building 7, and that's why it had to be destroyed.
That's, I think, a very widely held theory. And I think it's logical. Because on its own merits, there's no valid explanation as to why that building ever came down. It certainly, you just look at the video, it looks exactly like the building that's being brought down. The roof bends down, and the building comes straight down at the speed of a brick through the air. So, there's a lot of other problems with 9/11 that have not ever been really addressed. The whole NORAD going to sleep all day. I mean, there's never been a plausible explanation for why interceptors were failed to scramble in a timely fashion from bases that were within easy range to protect the targets.
Yeah,
there were fighters
That seems like the most telling evidence, because it would have been so easy to call someone closer. And that would have been the normal thing that anyone would think of. In an actual emergency, you call help from the nearest possible location.
The only fighters that were scrambled were from distant bases. And even in those cases, okay, those fighters should still easily have been able to reach the target. And I say this because initially, as I mentioned earlier, that the Pentagon said that they didn't scramble fighters until after all the damage had occurred. And then people said, what? That's insane. And they said, no. They said, we did scramble them. And then they gave answers to all of this. They said that the first base finally to scramble was Otis Air Force Base up in Massachusetts. This is about at 8:52. I'm looking this up now. Speaking to you. That's about a half hour after Flight 11 was taken over. That's 8 minutes after Flight 11 hit the North Tower. And it was just 9 minutes before that flight was to hit the South Tower. Even so, the speeds and the distances, when you calculate all of it, these jet fighters were clearly flying at speeds vastly slower than they could have been flying. For the aircraft to get where it was, the calculation is that it was flying less than 500 miles per hour, which is about a quarter of its top flight speed. So in other words, and the same thing applies to the situation at the Pentagon, where jets were scrambled from distant bases, flying at speeds of about 400 miles an hour. In other words, the flight of a commercial jet, if we're to believe the Pentagon's information.
No.
So again, flying at basically 25% of their top flight speed.
Okay, now there's a comment here, which is an excellent point, really. If these jet fighters had been scrambled immediately, what would they do over Manhattan?
Shoot the aircraft down.
They can't shoot them down over Manhattan.
Yeah, but Manhattan is an island, and before it gets to Manhattan, you've got water.
Okay, so they could have shot the planes down, but they would have been able to do it in a way that wouldn't have brought them down on top of the city.
Before you get to Manhattan, you've got the Long Island Sound.
Right.
You've got large bodies of water. I'm not saying it's the easiest thing in the world, but the fact is that
right,
protocols...
These guys are trained to do.
That's what jet fighters
do.
That's what fighter pilots do.
Yeah. So when you say this is difficult, it should have been a lot easier for them than it would be for most of us here listening.
And at the Pentagon itself, there were missiles. The Pentagon is a fortress. Not only do you have Andrews Air Force Base right there, none of those jets were scrambled, but the Pentagon itself had missiles, anti-aircraft missiles around it, that were supposed to be used for exactly that purpose, to protect the end of Pentagon from an air attack. And those missiles were never used.
Then there's the whole question of the training exercise. At first, people were saying, the official statements were saying, oh my gosh, crashing planes into buildings, we never even dreamed of something like that. And I remember hearing that over and over.
In fact, this was a scenario that had been practiced many times by the military. Recently, a year before, they were practicing scenarios in which they were to defend against air attack from terrorist hijacked aircraft that were slamming into major U.S. structures.
So it was exactly the same thing, really, as what happened that day. And then there seemed to be evidence that came out that indicated that those exercises were actually going on September 11th.
I first learned this in Michael Rupert's book, Crossing the Rubicon. It goes into this at great length. There was an operation going on that day, which was a military exercise along the Atlantic, Northeast Atlantic region, where all of this is happening. So it's a nice coincidence.
Yeah.
That, you know, someone's tipping off the Al-Qaeda organization. Or really more likely, of course, because one has to remember, Al-Qaeda, what is Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda was a creation of the Western intelligence community. That's primarily the Central Intelligence Agency. This is not conspiracy theory. This goes all the way back to the 1980s.
They weren't talking about Al-Qaeda right after the attacks either. They were talking about Saddam Hussein.
Well, they were talking about Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden was almost immediately, Osama bin Laden was promoted as the guy. He did it all. Although, yes, you're right.
So after the event.
That, well, you're right in that.
The event, it was all Saddam Hussein.
And then suddenly the
name changed.
Yes and no. I mean, there was early on this attempt to link Saddam. All disingenuous, of course. To 9/11. But they were right on bin Laden right from the beginning. Well. In fact, it was Saddam Hussein hated Osama bin Laden. Had nothing to do with the Al-Qaeda network. He didn't want them in his country. But, it's absolutely true that the Bush administration, tried to pin this on, of course, Saddam Hussein, and we all know how Americans were unable to distinguish between bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. They're all the same. Let's bomb them all. get home. So there is a lot of disingenuous mixing and matching there of people, absolutely. And then you had Condoleezza Rice talking about the mushroom cloud scenario. If we don't do something, we're going to have mushroom clouds in the country. She said that one a few times. And while we're on it, I know we're running out of time, but I want to bring up something that occurred a month later after 9/11. People remember this. It shouldn't be forgotten. And this is the anthrax scare.
Oh,
okay, remember. Now,
I forgot about that.
it was really, it provided the two to the 1-2 punch of 9/11. Now, the anthrax scare was all in October of 01, and this is all during the period when the Congress was shoving, getting the Patriot Act shoved through, with no one reading the damn thing, no dissent, of course. The Patriot Act, which, by the way, took your right and my right to true privacy away from us, so that the government can now legally read your email, can legally break into your house, and look for evidence, even if it's planted, who the heck knows, all of these things. That's our country. But it was the anthrax scare that pushed us all over the edge. Now, the anthrax was turned up at a number of various locations. It was mailed from different locations along the U.S. Eastern Seaboard. Anthrax in an envelope and all these packages through the postal service and all this stuff. Okay. And then it kind of died away. But during that scare, we were told how, well, this seems to be another terrorist attack. And then it went away until, I think it was about 6 years later, I think in 07, possibly 08, the researchers go back. But one person at the FBI apparently did his job, because the conclusion was that anthrax came from Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is the home and the all-time headquarters of U.S. biological warfare testing. All right, going back to World War II. So the anthrax came from Fort Detrick. Now, just stop right there.
But Al-Qaeda got...
Ah, there you go. So stop there and pretend that it's we're back in October 2001 and this information came out that the anthrax is from Fort Detrick. Did this make people suspicious? So then, once this conclusion was tamed by the FBI, now the damage control had to go in full gear. And what happened? Well, then we're told, yes, wow, it did come from Fort Detrick. Apparently, from one scientist who unfortunately has committed suicide, so we can't question him. And apparently he drove up and down the eastern seaboard mailing the anthrax from all these locations. Okay, that's the explanation for the anthrax.
And
I'm not making this up. I wish this were fiction.
Okay, so has anyone ever actually looked into the circumstances of his death? Maybe, because sometimes these officially reported suicide.
Well, that's
actually
a good question.
Multiple gunshot wounds.
Yeah, a la Gary Webb, right.
Yeah. Has anyone looked into where was he at the time when these things were posted from all these different locations up and down the Eastern Seaboard? I mean, if he was at somebody's wedding in one state on a day when one of these packages was being mailed from a different state, that would...
Right. Well, this is a very good question, and I have to honestly tell you, I have not delved in. I haven't investigated it to that extent, so I don't
know. Yeah, I haven't either. I would be really interested to know if anyone
has. Or how, or the exact nature of his suicide, and even, well, of course, what I guess I'll come out and say what I'm implying is that the man is suicided.
Yes.
Is something that goes on.
It's James Forrestal all over again.
Former Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, exactly. So who knows? We'll never know the true story about this man. But again, my point in raising the anthrax issue is simply any reasonable mind. You start looking at these things together as a unit. If you're not suspicious, then you're not, your brain's not turned on. This is very odd. And no questioning has been allowed of the official version of events, has really never been allowed. I mean, legally, you're allowed to question it. But see, what happens when you try to get to a certain point, and you get shouted down and ridiculed and ignored by a mainstream media conglomerate, basically five corporations that own everything, and then they're just not going to let you in. But people who have this idea, well, why isn't the media on top of this? Why isn't some brave politician on top of it? Well, there are, actually, some brave politicians who've discussed it. A few of them. There are some fringe media, like this station right here, that will discuss it. But if people really have this idea that NBC or Fox or CBS or PBS, whatever, that they're going to get into this, they have a completely obsolete idea of what the media is. They're back in 1950, 1920, I don't know. They're not in 2009. The media doesn't work like that. Those days are gone. We live in a completely managed media-type society where people are spoon-fed.
And it works on a lot of people. I remember, like, a year after 9/11 happened, going into work one day, and I said something. I was talking with one other person about 9/11 and that I felt it was an inside job. And I think all I said was that I thought there were a lot of questions that had not been answered satisfactorily. And another employee was right there, and she turned around and she said, oh, you're one of those conspiracy people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, what, you don't think there was a conspiracy? How did we have four people flying four different planes and there was no conspiracy at all? The official story said there was a conspiracy.
Okay. Exactly.
My whole thing is that I just said the official story had some gaps. That's it. But, got labeled. And, you know, I had people rolling their eyes and, oh, you're one of them.
Well, it's insult instead of argument.
Exactly, because no one was able to say, well, yeah, there are answers to everything.
You probably recall you and I went out for a dinner with two friends of ours who, a couple of years ago, and who knows why, I'm a masochist for this kind of stuff, but we were talking about 9/11, and I brought out my opinion that, yes, it was some form of an inside job. That can mean a lot of different things. And the woman, who was a friend of ours, said, well, that's impossible. Like, instantly said, that's impossible. And I said, well, no, it isn't impossible. It's certainly very possible. The question is, did it happen? But this is the response that I think so many people are inclined to have, that it's impossible.
And it so surprises me when even today, I hear people say things like this. Well, you know, of course, it was, you know, honey, sure. And, well, they found that one guy's passport, so of course, you know, that just proved that he was on the plane. Well,
to call it an inside, that's right, exactly. To call 9/11 an inside job, I mean, it's a very tendentious, very argumentative position. A lot of people get a defensive about it. Especially if they voted Republican in 2000, they're going to think, well, that you're attacking them or their guy, their president. And in fact, that's not what I believe is the case. I firmly believe that Al Gore been in the White House at that time, 9/11 still would have occurred and still would have been an inside job.
Yeah, because it's not just the Republicans, it's not just the Democrats.
And this wasn't just a presidential...
Yeah, so then, in other words, power longer than one presidential term or two.
We have a situation in which a global intelligence community really exists with no oversight, no effective oversight. Not just the American. I mean, when we think of the U.S. intelligence community, you've got to realize not just the CIA. There's an entire enormous family of agencies, and I'll guarantee you that we don't even know all of them. Some of them exist in the black. Okay, there's the CIA, you got the NSA, the DIA, you got the Naval Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, Army Intelligence. There are what are known as special access programs. These are black budget programs that have effectively no oversight from Congress and frequently no oversight from their own military service. We have lost control as a country over the black budget world. And that's just the U.S. Now, the U.S. has got the most money to play with in this regard, but other nations have shenanigans going on, too, with, again, little to no oversight. So, pretend, all right, that there's some kind of intel operation to engineer 9/11. It doesn't have to even have been fully an American organized thing. You could have international groups going involved in this. Could be American. There's reasons to suspect the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, which sent Mohammed Atta a payment of $100,000 shortly before 9/11. And the head of the Pakistani ISI was in Washington, D.C. that day, meeting with Rumsfeld and the other senior defense officials. That's a fact. There's also reasons to be suspicious, if nothing else, of the Israeli Mossad, an organization that gets a complete free ride in the American media. All right? And then you got all the U.S. groups. There are reasons to be suspicious of all of these. And so that, pretend you're the president, all right, and you're not involved in the planning. All you know is that some stuff's going to go down, and okay, so you'll have to deal with it. And then it goes down. You know that there's something that may not be right, but you better not ask about it, okay? And if you start sticking your nose where it's not supposed to be, that's going to be very, very bad to you, so just go along. It's not that he planned it or did it, although I think there's very good reason to suspect that Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were involved in some of the operation. But even they were not involved, I don't think, in making the decision. But the point is, that calling it an inside job doesn't necessarily mean that it's the president, you know, rubbing his hands together saying, ha ha ha, we're going to make this happen. No.
Yeah.
Not that simplistic or crass. If you're the president and you find out that this was...
Someone in power who knew something was up and had to have done something to let it happen.
I'm sorry, restate that.
I just felt like there had to be someone in power who knew, at the very least, that something was up and had to do something in order to let it happen. Either take action or not take action that they would normally have.
This is the argument that revisionist historians have made about Franklin Delano Roosevelt regarding Pearl Harbor.
I would love to get into that, but we are almost out of time.
We are, yes, I see that.
We've got like 1 minute left, and there was a question on the message board that I kind of wanted to slide in here. One person wanted to know if you think there might be an ET UFO connection to 9/11.
Well, yeah, I've often been asked that just because of what I study, and there's nothing overt that I can point to. But let me just say this, that you've got two huge truths that are essentially under the table that no one talks about. They're both enormous. If there's a connection, certainly that's something that, you know, if we had the information available, we would want to look at. The last thing I want to just say is that 9/11 is a day that has affected every single person on planet Earth, and we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to future generations to find the truth of what happened, because that day is the point on which all other subsequent points we've lived through hinge upon it. And if we don't have an open, full discussion of that critical day, it's like sore that will not go away. We'll live it until it's lanced. We have to lance the boil. We've got to get to the truth.
And I just want to mention for any listeners who aren't aware of this, I know, Rich, I know that your dad often listens to the show, and I would just like to say hi to him and give him a little shout-out because he actually did work at the World Trade Center.
He did indeed. I talked with my dad today on the phone, in fact, and he was a little down when we discussed 9/11.
Sure.
It hit him hard. He had the day off. He shared his job with a man who was killed that day. A very nice guy that you and I got to meet.
I remember spending a lot of that day trying to get hold of him.
Yeah, all morning, all afternoon. The lines were out. You couldn't get through, and I didn't know if my dad was alive or dead. And thank goodness he lived. But again, it was a hard thing for him. I think it'll be a hard thing for him for the rest of his life and for any person who had to live through this. A very deeply emotional, upsetting experience. If you tell anyone who went through it, it's hard for them not to cry.
Rich, thanks so much for joining me on them. I really am glad that we had a chance to talk about 9/11. I felt that it was really important in honor of all the people who did lose their lives that day and all the people who know someone, either were related or had a friend. And I think everyone in this country knows someone who was involved directly. And I just felt it was really something that I wanted to do, and I'm really glad that you were able to do this.
Well, me too, Karen. And I hope if there are those who think that this is all bogus or wrongheaded, at least let them understand that those of us who believe in what we call 9/11 truth do it out of respect and love for this country. It's not a sign of disrespect. But there are those of us who've looked into this, and we have serious problems with the explanation. It's not a political thing. I mean, I believe and love American history. I love it, and I believe in the ideals that this country was founded on. And it breaks my heart to see that we've moved so far away from a place where we can yet be. It's not impossible to get back to some level of government of the people, by the people, for the people. It can be done. We can do it.
Great. Well, thanks so much. And thanks to everybody who joined us this evening. And if you get a chance, light a candle for the people who lost their lives on 9/11, or have a moment of silence or something. Show our respect. Thanks to everyone who joined us. You've been listening to Through the Keyhole, live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. My guest this evening has been my husband, historian Richard Dolan, author of UFOs in the National Security State. Thanks again for listening, and see you all next week.